What if the secret to building real wealth isn't working harder, picking better, or knowing something that nobody else knows? What if it's actually doing less? I'll declare bias up front. That's exactly what I think. But I didn't think that once upon a time. Most of us don't. Most of us assume that money grows through effort. The people getting ahead financially, especially when it comes to investing, are the ones watching the markets, making the moves, and staying on top of it all. And then it became my job to watch this stuff. And then I started doing it. And it turns out both the studies and my own life experience will tell you that lazy is better, way better. And Sean Freer, Director of Global Exchange Indices at S&P Dow Jones Indices, is another one on Team Lazy.
Passive funds tend to outperform over the long term. There's roughly $6 billion New Zealand dollars invested in ETFs, and the majority of that would be passive.
Because here's what's wild. There's study after study on this, and in the latest one, they found that in the last 15 years, 86% of professional fund managers, people whose entire job it is to beat the market, they don't. What do they get beaten by? The lazy investor's best friend, an index fund.
The active managers aren't picking the winners all the time. So I don't know how retail investors can do that.
Now, here's the problem. We resist this because it just doesn't feel right. Doing more must get you more, surely. And this is your emotional side, sabotaging you, when actually you mostly need patience, low fees, and to get out of your own way.
The less you tinker, the more you can make in the longer term. The ETF is becoming the vehicle of choice for retail investors.
So, welcome to Making Sense. It's the podcast for people who want financial freedom without giving up their coffee. I'm Frances Cook, financial journalist and fellow financial freedom seeker who makes money simple for you. Today, the lazy way to get rich and why it actually works. This episode of Making Sense is supported by Odoo, the affordable way to get your business working smarter. Go to odoo.com, that's O-D-O-O.com for more. I want to help as many people as possible reach financial freedom by taking control of their money. You can help me in that mission. Two really easy ways. First, hit subscribe wherever you like to listen. YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any other podcast player. Then send this episode to a friend so we can all level up together. Then the show grows and I can keep giving you the money info that makes a difference for your life. Okay, back to it. Welcome, Sean. Thank you so much for coming in. Look, passive investing and index funds, I really feel like, I mean, I've been a fan for a really long time, but I feel like they have boomed in the last few years and really got people's attention. What are you seeing in terms of the response from people globally versus New Zealand? Is New Zealand sort of jumping on the train a little later?
I think so, and especially in terms of exchange-traded funds, New Zealand is a little bit behind the rest of the developed world, I'll say, on that front. And when I say the developed world, I mean US, Canada, Europe, Japan. I'm based in Asia. There's been a plethora of ETFs being launched in Asia and Australia as well, and all different types of flavors. So while we start off with a broad market exposure to a flagship index, you know, like S&P NZX 50 in New Zealand, S&P ASX 200 or 300 in Australia, plenty of S&P 500 ETFs. We've seen more complex ETFs being launched in all different flavors under the sun, under the rainbow, if you will.
It's super interesting, right? Because there's all these different ones. There's thematic ones, there's industry ones. Of course, as you say, there's the sort of standardized country ones like the NZX 50, top 50 companies in New Zealand. But you can actually go quite, you can thin slice a lot, can't you? What are you seeing in terms of the types of funds being launched these days?
First of all, not all the ETFs are passive, but I would say most of them are passive. We are seeing more active ETFs being launched. Now, a lot of asset managers realize that the ETF is becoming the vehicle of choice for retail investors. There's a lot less friction there to trade into an ETF and out. There's potentially more liquidity. So a lot of active managers are actually also moving their active strategies into the ETF vehicle. But the vast majority of assets are passive. At the end of 2025, there was just under $20 trillion US dollars in assets invested in ETFs globally.
That's a lot.
I calculated that in the back of my envelope to be about 33 trillion New Zealand dollars. Yeah, that's significantly grown a lot in the past five years or so. We've seen very high compounded annual growth rates of these asset volumes on ETFs with market growth. So security prices have grown. That's raised the level, but as well as net new inflows from investors. And yeah, some of those are net new assets from new investors, particularly around COVID as well. We saw a lot of new brokerage accounts being opened around the world, but also money that's come out of maybe mutual funds into ETFs as well.
Oh yeah, that's so fun. All right, we'll dive into some things on that soon. I want to sort of set the landscape first. You said about there's so many funds being launched. I mean, do we know how many funds? I mean, great number on the trillions invested, but how many funds are available for people to choose between?
I think there would be over 14,000 ETFs globally listed on stock exchanges the last time I checked.
Wow.
Maybe even a touch more than that these days. S&P Dow Jones Indices, as an index provider, we work with a lot of the ETF distributors to design indices for their products that are linked to their products. Some of them can be very niche, very thematic. Digital assets, ETFs with embedded options in them using covered calls, harvesting more dividends. There's ETFs, you know, there's sustainability, climate change, dividend orientated, technology or AI, thematically invested. Anything under the rainbow that you can think of, an investment product can be built and linked to a stock market index. So that really does help investors when it comes to their asset allocation. You know, you can very much be straight down the middle and get your broad market exposure, which could be seen as a smart way to access the ETF or a passive investment fund as a smart way to access a diversified portfolio. But for those more inclined to do so, you can trade into more niche parts of the market as well.
Yeah. And it's so bit interesting as well, when we've got so many choices now. I mean, we talk about active versus passive investing, which, you know, bias on the table. I love me a good passive strategy. I just think it's smart. It works really well. The data is there for a lot of it. But for anyone who hasn't come across that before, of course, active being you try to pick a bunch of companies, you think about where the market is going and you pick your winners. Whereas passive is you might just go really big and say, chuck my money in here. And basically the economy eventually grows over time. We continue. Even when you have that passive strategy, I feel like you can be almost actively passive now with so many options where you can say things like, I think AI is going to boom and going to be really important. And I'm going to have some sort of auto investment that goes into that as part of it. And I might have this global fund. That's the biggest part of it. But I want to have this AI exposure. So I'm going over here too. Or, you know, ethical investing, really important to me. So I'm going global, but it's with an ethical bent and according to this one. And I find it really great that you can be sort of, yeah, like I say, almost like actively passive, where you decide on, here's what I believe in for the world. And then you auto-invest and you just keep tracking with it. Do you think that's a bit of a shift in the investing landscape to have this many options? Or is that just something where maybe we haven't noticed it before and we're just talking about it more?
Certainly there's been a shift to a lot more niche-style ETFs that have been launched and passive strategies via mutual funds. And it does allow investors to really trade their views. They don't have to take a broad market approach. They certainly can, and it's very simple to set a portfolio that way and very cheap and a lot less friction now to do such a thing. But yeah, I mean, coming from an index provider, our indices are designed, you know, our broad market indices are designed to reflect the capital market depending on the objective of the index. So the S&P 500, for example, is designed to reflect the capital market of the largest 500 companies in the US. It does have a positive earnings per share screen in the methodology as well. So in New Zealand, the S&P NZX 50 is reflecting the largest 50 companies in New Zealand's capital market based on their free float. Now, investors may think there's some distortions in the market, and that can happen, and they're reflected in the index. You know, if there's been more concentration, Magnificent Seven, for example, they can make up around a third of the S&P 500 based on the valuations of those companies that the market sees them at. Now, are they overvalued? Are they not? That's not for me to say, but an investor can make can express a trade or a view based on their opinion. So there's an equal weight index, for example, S&P 500 equal weight, or there's a capped index where you cap the constituents. Maybe they think AI is the future and technology is the way to go, and you want more of your assets invested into that area, more investment exposure. So you can certainly certainly trade that way. There's enough. There's every, you know, it's like when I used to go into ice cream shops in New Zealand back in the day, there's 40 flavors. There's too many to choose from sometimes. It's similar with ETFs. There's all the flavors in this under the sun, and you can mix and match them and design the portfolio that you want to have with your views on the market.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's a really good point that I'd like to dive into a little bit more with you there, because I have heard criticisms on this for the funds. Like you mentioned, the S&P 500 there, 500 biggest companies in the US, dominated by tech. I mean, because they weight the index based on the size of the companies. So you say you put $10 or $100 or whatever into something like the S&P 500, the vast majority of that money might be going to, as you say, the Magnificent Seven, the biggest companies there. And then, you know, we look a little closer to home, NZX 50. Do correct me if my numbers are wrong on this, because you'll be more all over it than I am. But the last time I checked, is it the top 10 companies on the NZX 50 make up about a third of the value? So that's super interesting to me. So if you're doing something like that and you're buying the NZX 50, but the majority of your money is going to this top 10, are we kidding ourselves that that means that our money is sort of diversified and spread around? What do you think?
I don't know if we're kidding ourselves, so to speak, but I mean, let's go back to the mechanics of our broad market indices are what we call float market capitalization weighted. So they're weighted by the free float. We remove the strategic shareholders. We want the companies to be tradable and measure their free float. So the larger companies certainly do have more weight in the index. And you see that across many different countries. You know, in Korea, Samsung is a really large component of their domestic market index. In Taiwan, the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company. In the US, you've got the Magnificent Seven. In Australia, you've got the big four banks and a couple of the miners. And in New Zealand, yeah, you've got the top 10. You're bang on. It's about 2/3 of the index. In the past, 15 years, it has been higher than that, and it has been lower than that. It does fluctuate depending on, the index is reflecting the capital market. As I said, if more people are investing in the larger capped companies, larger sized, they'll take up more weight. If there's more spread across mid and small caps, then the distribution of the weight will be a bit more even. But there are other ways to invest if you don't believe in putting your money in market capitalization weighted indices. There are price weighted indices out there, like the Dow Jones Industrial Average. There's equal weighted indices as well. There's other ways to invest your money if you don't believe in, or if you believe the index has too much concentration. But sometimes the concentration's there for a reason. It's reflecting what all the investors and all the market participants, all the superannuation, Kiwi savers, asset managers, and individuals think that those companies are worth at that point in time.
Well, I was going to say, the counter argument, just for me to be a real fence sitter here, the counter argument is, why wouldn't you want to invest in success? That those big companies are big for a reason because they're doing well. And of course, you'd want more of your money allocated there. So I kind of run with the foxes and hunt with the hounds on this one, where I really see both sides.
Well, the other side of the coin is, would you do better off if you were stock picking individual shares or securities and built your portfolio that way? And I mean, we've proven there's research out there that even very, very smart professional investors, otherwise known as asset managers and fund managers, they don't actually outperform indices themselves that they're benchmarked to. The New Zealand SPIVA report came out just last week. So if you Google SPIVA New Zealand, you can see what percentage of active managers underperformed the S&P NZX 50. There's also a global and a fixed income universe as well. And over long-term, 10, 15 years, it's 85% of them underperform the index. Short-term, it fluctuates. And that's the same results appear in Australia, in the US, in Japan. We do SPIVA for a lot of different countries and regions. The active managers aren't picking the winners all the time. So I don't know how retail investors can do that unless they're very skilled.
That stat, I'm so glad you brought it up, because I looked at that stat and I was like, I've got to talk to him about that, because that's incredible to have so many of the people who have gone to university, trained in this, often have master's degrees, have worked in it for years, and then the vast majority of them, more than 3/4, are not managing to beat the index. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, I worked in asset management, investment managers for most of my career. They have the CFAs, they have large investment teams, and they all sound, very smart, But as a retail investor, and they do outperform the benchmark certain market conditions or environments or periods, but it's proven they don't have the persistence as well. And that's another interesting element. If some people are investing in an active fund and they look at the fact sheet and they see, oh, it's outperformed the last 12 months or 3 years, these guys must know what they're doing, they're good. Well, it's actually proven if they've already outperformed that in the next 3 years that they're likely to underperform because the winners have already run and they have to reposition the portfolio for the next 3 to 5 years. And it doesn't always happen dynamically. There can be some painful periods where they do underperform in certain environments. And active managers have investment styles. You know, they like telling you about their investment process. We're a GARP, we're growth at a reasonable price, or a value manager, or we're a quant. You know, we use mathematical systems to invest. But the research stands for itself. The passive funds tend to outperform over the long term.
Yeah, this is the thing as well. And especially when you add in things like the fees, I always say to people, just do not ignore fees.
Exactly. Yeah.
Fees are little bugs that eat your money in ways that just build up so much over time, so much more than people think. You mentioned before as well about the different ways that markets can be, the different companies that can dominate. And I find this fascinating. I did a deep dive on it in a newsletter recently, but I should do more because there's so much you can do on this. And like you say, in Australia, you've got big banks and mining dominate. In America right now, it's tech. New Zealand also has its own dominating companies, right? Its own dominating industries, its own ways that the market is different from the rest of the world, right? What makes our market different?
I mean, every market's unique, and that's why it's good to be diversified. You know, S&P came on board and partnered with the exchange in June 2015. You know, started rebranding all the indices S&P NZX, and we launched a whole bunch of new indices at that time, high dividend indices, ESG indices, climate change indices, fixed income ones. But I've been looking back at the last 10 years, and the top 10 companies has changed since the launch. You know, we saw maybe four or five companies that were top 10 in 2015 have dropped out of the top 10. And yeah, now your Fisher and Paykels and healthcare companies make up a large component. But the sectors have changed. The sector weights have changed. If you go back to 2003, that was when the NZSE 50 started. So before it was even branded S&P NZX 50, Spark was the largest company in the index at the time. And telecommunication services sector was more than 30% of the index, which is now rebranded Communications Services, the GIC sector, by the way. And you had a lot more consumer companies in New Zealand in the index, you know, 10, 20 years ago, whereas now it's more, more healthcare and industrials.
This episode of Making Sense is supported by Odoo. Be honest, how many subscriptions are you paying for right now to run your business or side hustle? Because I reckon it's more than you'd like to admit, and half of them don't even work together. That's exactly why I like Odoo. It's one platform with 70 apps, accounting, invoicing, sales, inventory, HR, your website, no extra subscriptions, no new logins. It's all already there, starting from $34.40 Aussie dollars per user per month. And the first app is free for life, hosting and support included. Try it for free for 15 days, no card details needed. Go to odoo.com, that's O-D-O-O.com. Quick interruption to say, if you're enjoying this episode, you'll love the Market Memo, my weekly newsletter where I teach you how to actually invest. No jargon, no spreadsheets, just real talk about shares and how to make your money work for you. It's the thing I wish I'd had when I was starting out. You can sign up for free at francescook.co.nz/invest. That's francescook.co.nz/invest. But don't worry, I'll put the link in the show notes and the description of this podcast. All right, back to it. And it's super interesting as well when you said there about, you know, you've got funds that are focused on things like dividends. I imagine that's quite easy in New Zealand because we're very, we're not so much of a growth market. Like you might see in the US, especially with all the tech companies that are focused on grow, 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 get bigger. The idea there is the company's going to be worth more. It's a growth strategy and your shares themselves become worth more. Whereas New Zealand, We're a bit quieter, right, in terms of we have a lot of those companies that are solid and proven. And so you kind of already know what you're getting. You might not be getting the growth, But the dividends, in terms of their solid companies, they have profits, they share them around. That's more kind of our style, right?
Yeah, well, we have total return indices and price return indices. And if you compare the difference in them, one includes all the dividend payouts and one only includes the security price changes. And actually, the dividend component is a large part of a company's growth profile. And yeah, I think the dividend payout ratio in US companies is below New Zealand and Australia, I'd say that. But yeah, in some countries, like I think Taiwan, companies have very high payout ratios. So dividends are certainly an element to consider in your investment strategy. And some people love having a dividend-oriented. So we have a dividend-oriented index. There's S&P NZX 50 high dividend. You'd have to invest in a product linked to that index, but then you'd get a higher dividend yield compared to the S&P NZX 50 dividend yield. So that index has been weighted by dividend payout ratios and consistent dividends from companies. We even have franchises globally. Dividend Aristocrats is an S&P franchise. And to be in that index, you have to have maintained dividends for 25 years. So that's a US or global index. If we tried to use that methodology in single countries, you might not get that many constituents. So certainly that's one way to invest. There's different tax treatments of dividends in different countries. And I think that might have held back ETFs in New Zealand is the tax treatment on dividends. But yeah, that's certainly one interesting way to invest. And we can cater for that with our index design is to be dividend orientated.
Super interesting, your little side mention there of Taiwan. I don't know heaps about the Taiwan market, but cards on the table. Do you know why they tend to be more dividend oriented? Is that a business culture thing?
I don't know, but I was involved in an index launch with an asset manager there for an ETF, and they really wanted a higher dividend yield in the we back test indices before we launch them, and we try out different scenarios, and I was quite surprised because there's pros and cons. You know, if a company's paying out too much dividends, they're not reinvesting that in the business. So every company is on a different life cycle, different journey about how much they want to, you know, reward shareholders for holding their shares or how much they want to put that money back into their company and reinvest it for future growth. And I'm not a corporate finance executive that makes those decisions, but like any other investor out there, I do love a dividend.
Yeah, exactly. I know, it's really interesting, isn't it? The different approaches people can have on that, because yeah, some people love, they can almost, be looking to treat dividends as like a fixed income sort of idea where they're like, okay, I won't have to sell any shares and I can just get money coming through by dividends. And then you see particularly the US culture by investors is they almost sometimes disapprove of dividends. Like, why are you not reinvesting that money back into the company to grow? So I find it super interesting, the different investing cultures by country. And coming back to the idea of New Zealand and how we invest, I mean, do you think there's been a change in the uptake on index funds and the passive investing strategy from New Zealanders in the last few years? Do we have any numbers on that?
Yeah, I don't have the numbers exactly on the split between passive and active investing in New Zealand. Certainly on the ETF front, it's easy to measure. There's roughly $6 billion New Zealand dollars invested in ETFs, and the majority of that would be passive.
Because there's that famous finding, isn't there, that people who forget about their investments often do better. And it really does seem like every time I read a new study that comes out, it really seems like so much of good investing is deciding on what you want from your money, set it, forget it, leave it alone. Is there any data on that? Or have we had any recent stuff on people who've forgotten about their investments?
You know, I've heard of set and forget portfolios. I've heard of couch potato portfolios.
I haven't come across that term for it before. I quite like that.
There's been studies out there. The less you tinker, the more you can make in the longer term. If you set your investment allocations according to your goals and stick to that over the longer term, there's a higher probability that you'll be successful than if you keep trading, handing over fees to brokerages, to, you know, other counterparties in the mix. So
yeah, well, exactly. I feel like every time we trade, I mean, the big things that keep coming through is your emotions will get in the way. As much as you think they won't, often when we want to make a change, it can be driven by emotion. And emotions and money just never mix. But also the problem is the fees, right? Every time you're buying and selling, that usually has a cost attached to it. And it can depend a lot, depending on what platform you're using. But those fees can add up in all sorts of ways. The buy and the sell, the foreign exchange fees, all of those various things can really start to get expensive when you're messing around with it.
And there's the opportunity cost, as well as the fees. I mean, I lived through the 2008 financial crisis, and I actually got made redundant that year and lost my job.
Love that.
And luckily, I didn't really have many liabilities, but I had a lot of fun with my redundancy money. I went traveling. I went to the World Cup in South Africa the next year. And the market in 2009 went up quite a lot. And I could have invested that money at the bottom with my redundancy money. So I think that's a good buy signal is when you get made redundant to put that into the market. But personal stories aside, I mean, in 2020, we saw a massive, drawdown globally with the pandemic. The New Zealand market had a big drawdown. And I was just looking at the data earlier today. The New Zealand market returned 13.9%. When I say the New Zealand market, I mean the S&P NZX 50 in 2020. Now, if you had have sold in March, April, or May, you would have ended in the red. Or I don't know when that market turned specifically in New Zealand, but you would have ended in the red by thinking, oh my God, my portfolio is down. I need to sell. So you're missing out on the upside if you sell in despair or when there's a bit more volatility. You know, we've seen the war in Iran come up this year. The New Zealand market was down 1.7% year to date. Now, if investors want to jump out then, they might miss any upside. And you know, we've already seen the S&P 500 actually reach new records since the war in Iran. It's crossed over 7,000 points, the index level. So plenty of investors are still bullish about the future of those tech type companies and US companies, even amid concerning geopolitical tensions. So if you sell during an all-time high, is that a good time to sell? I'm not here to say, but if you sell during an all-time high, it's proven there's more than 50% chance the next day will be higher, 55% chance, I think, on the S&P 500. And what if you sell in the next month or the next 3 months after an all-time high? Well, the probability of an all-time high is even higher. And then next 12 months later, there's 99% chance of another all-time high within 12 months of an existing all-time high. Thinking that you can, tactically allocate and sell during a bit of an up market, you're potentially missing out on better returns.
Well, exactly. I should be able to quote this off the top of my head because this gets cited all the time. But I think that it's the vast majority of the market peaks. And like you say, those all-time highs come within 10 days of the biggest market lows. So if you see the market go down and you panic and you think, oh gosh, like not a good time to be here, quick sell everything, you almost guarantee, as much as anything can be guaranteed in finance, which you can't, but you almost guarantee that you will miss that upswing, which tends to come hot on the heels of that downswing. And that's why it's that idea of letting emotions influence your money is always horrendous. I often come back to the buying, the selling, you almost need to ignore what's happening. It's almost more about what's happening in your personal life. Do you need to sell for your goals? You know, have you hit a particular goal and now you're going to move the money elsewhere? Or, you've hit the retirement phase of life, so you're in the spending phase of life. Like, that's all far more relevant to me than what the market is doing that particular day. I kind of feel like I find that stuff interesting, but I shut it out for my own investing strategy.
A good portfolio for an investor to have with their goals and with their age would be well diversified across more of the broad market indices. And then you don't really need to concern yourselves with the daily moves and the geopolitical conflicts and all that sort of thing. If you stick to your plan, you possibly end up coming out better. Whereas if you do get involved in some of those, and I mentioned there's plenty of possibilities out there, we've got all the flavors under the rainbow of different ETFs and different investment strategies and very niche thematic. You need to watch the market a lot closer then and be strategic with your investing. But then there's the behavioral finance element that comes into play as well. And I can speak from my own personal experience. Long before I worked for an index shop, I don't know why, but I used to sell winners and hold on to my losers. And that's the worst thing you can do. I thought if I've made 10, 15%, that's great. I should take profit. And then when I used to have some individual stocks that were down 30 or 40%, and I was thinking, well, they're cheap now. I should buy more. And they might keep going down. And sometimes they're cheap for a reason. I mean, there's plenty of self-directed retail investors now that can build their own portfolio and get a nice, you know, asset allocation and set and forget. And other people might do that through advice. But either way, less hands-on is probably the better approach.
I know. I just, especially since I've had kids, I was talking about this earlier. I was just like, I just chuck it in a global fund and move on with my day because I cannot pay attention to any of that stuff. And here I am, someone that talks about money for a living, but it's just easier. And I just like the easy ways to stay investing. And it's just so much better for me. There's one of the things that I see discussion and debate about as more people get into the index investing and the really big funds, which again, cards on the table, I just think it's vast majority of the time a really good strategy, but that it can maybe create sort of market distortions where people just keep putting money in and they maybe miss some of the nuance of the market. I think that's the criticism, especially from those who favor a more active strategy. What do you make of that argument?
The indices that my company develop, manage, produce, calculate, they're designed to have different objectives, and a broad market index is designed to reflect the capital market, and that it could be distortions there. If investors are piling into certain segments or sectors based on geopolitical situations, part of the economic cycle, more money moving into passive, you know, you do get more money coming into the larger market cap companies in that. But then those distortions can arbitrate themselves out, or you know, we did see a big distortion in 2001 with the dot-com bubble. There was a lot of internet type companies that were extremely, you know, highly priced or overvalued, depending on your opinion. And then there was the bust around 2001, was it? And a lot of asset managers in those days, the value managers didn't hold all those expensive companies, and they did better. But the growth funds did, because they were growth companies. And maybe we're experiencing something like that now with the tech companies and AI. It's not for me to say, are these segments overvalued or not? But certainly you can trade your view based on all the different options out there now, whether you can go equal weighted, whether you can short sell indices through futures and options contracts. You can invest in specific sectors or segments or themes. You can get a global equity portfolio ex-US if you think the US market's overvalued itself. So there's certainly a lot of choice for investors to implement their view.
Yeah. I just find the boom in it fascinating. And I think the biggest takeaway for me is I'm just excited that the average person is more involved in the idea of growing their money, getting a piece of that pie. Because the more complicated investing seems, the more people say, oh, I'll do it soon. But soon can take a really long time. I can tell you that myself. Way back when I was in my early 20s, and we don't need to talk about how long ago that was, and I knew that things like changing my KiwiSaver or starting investing was important, but it was just too hard basket. And I just love that we've got these funds now that you can just go, oh, whatever. I know that I need to have a bunch of different companies and I can do that. Have we seen much sort of growth in terms of New Zealand? What is it? So you've been involved in New Zealand very directly since 2015. Have you seen much change in terms of the uptake and also what we're interested in?
Yeah, certainly it's been an uptick in individuals with brokerage accounts, especially during COVID. A lot of people started investing. A lot of younger people are also investing as a hobby. Which is great to see. Even if they are investing in single stock securities, they might find that fun. They may find that fun, you know, looking at different companies and different sectors and industries and thinking that could be a potential, you know, have potential growth in the future. And sometimes you can find out hard lessons when you're young with money doing that. But other times you learn from those things and you evolve, and maybe you realize that the diversified passive approach is best. Maybe you don't. The ETFs has democratized investing in a way. It's much more accessible for people to invest. We've all got phones on our hands now with apps, with, you know, brokerage accounts that we can easily trade sitting on the bus or during our commute if we really want to. So the access is there. How you go about it? Are you looking at building capital to potentially use a deposit for a house? Are you looking at, you know, something risky, or, you know, I mentioned couch potato before. The other side of the coin is the white knuckle. Yeah. You know, some younger people are getting into the cryptocurrencies or the very volatile penny stocks, and they might want to go down that route. A few might become successful doing that. Majority probably not. Some people tend to be quite loud about their wins and keep very quiet about their losses. So there's also the behavioral finance element there. But I think it's a good thing if younger investors are playing with a little bit of money, not a lot, and they're learning their lessons at that time. And then when they earn more money later on in their career or their lives, or they have more wealth, that they make the better decisions then, whether it's through advice or through self-directed.
Yeah, well, I mean, learning by doing, right? Incredibly powerful. That's one way to give yourself a bit of a finance education. It's quite interesting as well, because companies actually lobby to be included in the indices, right? I mean, what do you think that tells us about the power of the index?
They can lobby all they like, but we don't. We have clear rules and methodologies that are transparent and online about how an index is calculated, what the eligibility criteria is of that index, what the objective of that index is. I mean, on the S&P 500, if a company tries to lobby us to get into that index, we'll just say thank you for your email.
Brutal.
We don't even entertain them. I mean, we're an independent index provider. In Australia and New Zealand, we do have S&P Dow Jones indices partners with the exchanges here, the NZX and the ASX. So we have a little bit of skin in the game in the capital market here, and we do want a robust, tradable, liquid capital market. And companies can ask us, like, how do we get in the index? And I'll take the call and talk to them about it. But they can't lobby their way in. I mean, even just earlier today, I was presenting to listed companies on the NZX, or companies who are about to list on the NZX, about the index, about the methodology, about the ranking system. There are buffers too. It's not simply the top 50 that are in. You need to be ranked top 44th or above to be added to the index. So we limit that kind of turnover and churn. And if a company drops out, it has to drop below the 56th ranking for the S&P NZX 50 as well. So by accessing the 50, the S&P NZX 50, you are accessing more invested capital. You are on the radar of KiwiSavers and fund managers. Even active fund managers have to make a decision about you. Should we buy this company or not? Even if they don't buy that company, they're taking an active position by not holding you in terms of their portfolio risk metrics and tracking error versus the index, etc. So, but that doesn't guarantee you, when you're a company, you're added to the S&P NZX 50, that you're always going to stay there. You need to run a good business, grow your earnings, pay out the dividends. If you don't meet your earnings targets, or your sector has a bit of a downturn or whatever the business model is, you'll drop out and another company will replace you in that index.
Oh, fascinating stuff. We've covered so much ground in this interview. I'm loving picking your brains. If people were listening to this and they only took one thing from it, what do you hope is the thing that sticks with people from today?
You know, if you are investing passively, be aware of what that means. So you're investing passively to a stock market index. What is that index? Go online, look it up. You can see the methodology, the objective, and just confirm that's the exposure that you want to have with your investing. I'd also suggest that, yeah, when you are considering different strategies, whether it's active or passive, it has been proven that the passive investment strategies do outperform over the longer term. So that's probably another key takeaway I'd leave your listeners and viewers with.
You got the stats on it. Yep. We love all the stats and reports that you guys put out. Actually, before I let you go, if people do want to look at all the wonderful research that your company produces, hit us with the website so people can go and have a look at that if they want.
Yeah, if you just Google S&P Dow Jones Indices, we have a website, and then you can find your way to whatever index you like. SPIVA New Zealand, S-P-I-V-A New Zealand. If you look up that, you'll find the report that we launched last week. We update it every 6 months to June 30 and December 31, and we measure the performance of active managers versus key benchmarks in New Zealand, including the S&P NZX 50.
Love it. Thank you so much for your time. Sean Freer, S&P Dow Jones Indices. I love the work that you guys put out. Now, if this episode was helpful to you, then send it to a friend. We can all level up our money together. Until next time, have a great day.
This podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most situations. It's not individual financial advice. If you're after that, a financial advisor is always the best bet.